Acts is full of stories of conversion, of people making a change, of people changing the way they think about something or the way their heart is oriented to the world or the way they understand things. And one of the most spectacular conversions is the story of Saul. Saul was a highly intelligent, highly respected Pharisee within Judaism. He had spent a lot of time in Jerusalem, and he was so angry about the people who claimed that Jesus was the Messiah. He was so almost rabid in his hatred and his desire to uphold the holiness of true Israel and true Judaism and God's own people and purify God's own people. And so he went and he was participating in the arresting that was happening and the persecution that was happening of Christians, of followers of Jesus at the time. They weren't really called Christians yet, but of followers of Jesus at the time. And so he had gone to the leaders and said, hey, if you would give me letters that give me permission, I happen to be traveling for the long weekend or whatever, up to Damascus. And I am bound to come across some of these Christians, some of these heretics. And so if you give me a letter, that'll give me permission and these guys I've got with me, and we'll arrest them and we'll bring them back for trial and prison and all the other things that we can dream up together. And so he was set. He was a guy who was super focused. I think some of us might know people like this. They're kind of exhausting to be around, eh? Like they know what they want and they go after it with everything that they have, and nothing can sway them from their path. And they're just fully on and inboard in this. And so he's traveling to Damascus when all of a sudden this bright light knocks him right down into the ground. If he was riding a horse or something, knocked him right off that. If he was just walking still, knocked him right over. And then this voice says, stop persecuting me. Well, he can't see anybody. There's just this bright light. Well, who are you? Who on earth am I persecuting? Who's this talking to me out of this bright light? It's Jesus. And there's this incredible change that happens in Saul. Something about that voice, something about that experience, and he had an immediate just conversion. It's the only word for it. He turns, he does a 180-degree turn in the way that he thinks about Jesus and who Jesus was and who Jesus is and who the disciples are. And he goes from being this rabid persecutor of Christians to being one who ends up being persecuted, who ends up being martyred, who travels all over the Roman Empire and is one of the most prolific evangelists that we have. So much of the New Testament, I wonder if we'd have a New Testament if it wasn't for Paul. So many of the letters in there are written by Paul or attributed to Paul. He discipled so many people. He established, he worked in lots of different places. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary story. The problem with the story of Paul is that we read it so often and we say, well, I don't really have a story like that, so I don't have a conversion story, or I don't have anything nearly dramatic, so my story isn't really as much worth sharing. And so I don't want us to just focus on Paul and his story, because there's not very many of us who resonate with Paul's story. It's great. I love that God did that. But I also want to look at the other guy in the story, this guy named Ananias. Ananias was already a Christian. Ananias was already a disciple of Jesus. Ananias was living, going about his own business in Damascus. And all of a sudden, he has a vision. I want you to go. You'll find this guy on this street. He's blind. I did that. I want you to go, and I want you to tell him about me, and I want you to heal him. By the way, this is the guy that's hunting you. This is the guy that wants to see you imprisoned. This is the guy who would be quite happy if you were stoned to death. Ananias, who's not an idiot, says, what? That's not safe. That's not wise. What are you talking about? But Jesus convinces him, this vision, he's convinced he has to do this, and so he follows. And this, I think, is, we're going to see this again, because I'm going to point to a couple other stories. We think of conversion as this thing that I wasn't a Christian and then I became a Christian. And for some of us in this room, there's a clear point when we went from not being a Christian to being a Christian. For others in this room who say grew up in the church, grew up and kind of made commitments at 4 years old and again at 12 years old and again at 15 years old and over at different times, we don't have a clear point in the road when we can say this is when I became a Christian. And so we think, I don't really have a conversion story. I wasn't really converted. And when I read this story and I read a couple others in the Bible, I think conversion is something that's constantly happening. I think it's another word for what the Holy Spirit does in us. I think, yes, that decision we make that says, I'm going to be a follower of Jesus, it's an important decision. It happens at some point in our lives. We have to actually make that decision. It doesn't happen by default. But then the rest of our lives are about the Holy Spirit working in us, constantly converting us, constantly changing us, constantly making us more and more and more like Jesus. Sometimes it's about converting or changing the way we think about things. Sometimes it's about changing our heart and our attitudes, our outlook toward the world around us, our understanding of ourselves. I think conversion is a lifelong process. When we invite Jesus into our hearts, when we invite the Holy Spirit to take up residence, when we say, I will be a follower of Jesus, we're actually signing on for a lifelong journey of conversion. And I think that's some of what was happening with Ananias in this story. We have no reason to think that there was anything wrong with Ananias as a follower of Jesus, that he was a solid disciple. We don't really know much about him. But there was fear, and the fear made sense because Paul was a scary guy and because people were being arrested, because people were being persecuted. Earlier in Acts, we read the story of Stephen, another one of Jesus' disciples, who was stoned to death by like this mob of angry people who hated what he stood for and what he was proclaiming. And so there was good reason that he was afraid. And so he could have said, no, I'm not doing that. I think God always gives us the option to say no. And God, if he appears to us in a vision or it's just a quiet whispering in our hearts, I think God always gives us the option to say no when he invites us into something. We can say, no, I'm not doing that. That is too scary for me. Or that is too costly for me. Or that, I just don't have time for that right now, God. He always gives us the opportunity to say no. Ananias said yes. After he first said no, but then he said yes. And I think that constitutes a conversion, that something shifted inside of him. Yes, what God was asking him was terrifying. It could cost him his life. But in saying yes, he declared that following where he was being called into by God was more important than being ruled by fear. What an incredible conversion. I mean, how many of us, last week we talked about slavery. How many of us find ourselves enslaved by fear? We maybe hear a whispering. Maybe God is calling me here. Maybe this is something that I'm invited into. Maybe it's not a specific calling. Maybe it's just actually living the way that Jesus says. It can be frightening. Do we need to be converted out of our fear into faith? There's another story that I want to tell you about. We're not going to go through and read the whole thing. It happens in Acts chapter 8. And it's the story about an Ethiopian eunuch. He was an important slave or servant, but he worked in the palace. He was an important man. And he took care of the entire, what does it say? In 8:27, we're told he's in charge of the queen of Ethiopia's entire treasury. So he's got it made. He has status, he has position, he probably has great wealth. We're also told that he has come to Jerusalem to worship. So he's what we would call a Jewish proselyte. He's not Jewish, but he has somewhere along the line heard about the God of Israel, and he's actually gone to Jerusalem to worship this God. He's one of these, and there were people like this who weren't Jewish by birth, but had adopted what they could of Judaism. And so he'd gone to Jerusalem to worship. And then he was on his way back, and he's reading his Bible. So that's another sign. There's something about this guy, this man, this Ethiopian, who doesn't really know anything about too much about the whole Jewish faith. He's not He's not tied to it by blood. He's reading from the prophet Isaiah. One of Jesus' disciples, Philip, shows up and says to him, "Oh, what are you reading?" "I'm reading this Isaiah." He says, "Oh, what does it mean to you? Do you understand it?" The Ethiopian's like, "No. Who on earth could understand this?" See, Isaiah is a prophecy, right? Isaiah writes, and he writes some fantastical visions and has some things to say, and it doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't make any sense to most people. And Philip spends some time with him. I picture him kind of hopping up in the chariot with him and saying, "Well, let's talk about this." And Philip takes the words that the Ethiopian is reading, and he says, "This is all, let me tell you about Jesus." He's never heard of Jesus. "Let me tell you about Jesus. All of this that you're reading from the prophet Isaiah, who wrote this so many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, he was writing about this guy named Jesus." And he proceeds to tell him the whole story of Jesus. And you know what the Ethiopian's response is? His response is, "Oh, this is what I've been looking for. Hey, look, there's some water. Can I be baptized?" Philip says, "Sure, absolutely." So they hop out of the chariot and they go, and this Ethiopian is baptized. And then we don't hear a thing about him ever again in the Bible. Presumably, he goes back to work. Presumably, he goes back to his country. Presumably, he's a changed man. His understanding has changed. He had limited understanding about things, but clearly something resonated with him, and he was converted. His mind, his understanding was converted to a greater understanding that all of this pointed to Jesus. Now, I was reading an article. It's an article in Christianity Today about the current Ethiopian prime minister. The prime minister of Ethiopia is a Christian. And I want to read for you. There's this list of things this prime minister did in his first 100 days of office. He spent his first 100 days as prime minister lifting the country's state of emergency, granting amnesty to thousands of political prisoners, discontinuing media censorship, legalizing outlawed opposition groups, dismissing military and civilian leaders who were suspected of corruption, and significantly increasing the influence of women in Ethiopian political and community life. He's also pledged to strengthen democracy by holding free and fair elections. In his first 100 days. And all of it is inspired, as has been inspired around the world, by a Christian prime minister who's not just Christian in name because it'll get him votes, but is Christian in practice from the things that he's doing. And I wonder, is this the legacy? We've never heard anything about the Ethiopian eunuch. After he meets Philip, Philip disappears. That's the end of that story. But 2,000 years later, is that because of what God did in this one man? As he opened up, as he changed his understanding, as he converted him to really believing and knowing Jesus and deciding to be baptized? I wonder. In Acts 10, one chapter after Paul's story, there's a story of a man named Cornelius. And Cornelius was a prominent Roman soldier and a Roman citizen. He's a Gentile. We're pretty sure he was also a Jewish proselyte, meaning that he was also worshiping God. He was called a God-fearing man who's spoken well of by the whole Jewish nation. So that gives us a sense that there's some kind of connectedness to the Jewish religion and to the God of the Jews. And he has this vision again, and he's told to go seek out this guy named Peter, who's one of the apostles. At the same time, Peter has this vision, and this is a popular kind of Sunday school story because it's fantastic. And so Peter's having a nap on the roof of his house, as you would in that day and age, because it was nice and cool up there, and the roofs were flat, not like ours. And so he's having a nap up on the roof, and he has this vision of this sheet full of all this different kind of food and all these different animals coming down from heaven. Now, most of the animals, or all of the animals on this sheet, were considered unclean. They had been banned by God from the beginning of Israel's history. God had said, "You can't be eating these kind of animals." And it comes down, and the voice that goes with the vision says, "Eat." And Peter, of course, being a good, solid Jewish man, yes, a follower of Jesus, but he was pretty faithful to the Jewish law and the ways of doing things. He was like, "I've never let this unclean food pass my lips. Why would I do that now?" No, thinking, I'm sure, this is a test. This is a test to see if I'm still really a follower of God. And this happens multiple times. that he's invited to eat. And eventually, do you know what the voice, which is the angel of God, the voice of God, has to say to him? Let nothing that I have declared clean be called by you unclean. There's different words that he uses in it, but that's the essence of it. Next thing he knows, as he's trying to process what just happened, there's a knock on the door. And it's this Roman soldier, this Gentile, who says, I came here because I was sent by a vision to look for Peter. Will you come to my house? Peter's a good Jew. He can't go to the house of a Gentile, which is full of all sorts of traps because it's full of all sorts of unclean things because they're not going to be following the laws of Jerusalem. And so Peter, this vision fresh in his mind, goes, this can only be from God. Yes, I will go. And he goes and he tells Cornelius and his whole, like all the people who live in his household would have been his family, his slaves and servants, friends of the family. It was a full household. And Peter goes into this Gentile's house. He partakes of a meal with them. What that meant was he was not going to be able to go to the temple anytime soon. He was not going to be able to go around other Jewish people at any time because he'd been contaminated. And yet he went and he shared the gospel, and Cornelius and his whole household become followers of Jesus. Now, Luke includes this. Luke is the writer of Acts, we're pretty sure. And Luke includes all of this because he's making a case for this Gentile mission, saying the whole point of Jesus is bigger than Judaism. Jesus didn't just come for Israel. Jesus came for the whole world. But I think as well, there's something so fantastic in this. Yes, there's this conversion of this Roman soldier, of this guy who has influence of power, this guy who was already considered a God-fearer, who was already kind of enamored by the God of Israel. And there's his conversion. But I think the more spectacular conversion is Peter's. Peter's already a follower of Jesus. But then what happens? He has to be converted away from all the rules and the way he's always been taught and always known was the right way to be a person that was a follower of the God of Israel. And suddenly everything's widened and opened up to say, you have to make room for Cornelius and all of his friends. Now, interesting about Peter, Peter backs off of this whole Gentile mission a little bit later on. Peter gets overcome by fear later on in his story. And he's like, no, we can't be doing this. This is causing too much trouble. And it's Paul who holds him. They have a big fight. Paul holds him to account. And Paul says, you yourself had this incredible vision. You yourself launched the whole Gentile mission by going into Cornelius's house. You know that God is in this. And Peter had to once again be converted. Peter had to once again acknowledge, you're right. I let fear get in the way. And God is doing something here. Despite the fact that we don't think God should be doing something with the Gentiles, despite the fact that we don't think this is the way that God should be working, God is clearly working in this. And so we have to figure out what we do with the law and all of those rules, because it was very, very clear that God said, what I have made clean, how dare you pronounce it unclean? And he was speaking about Cornelius and his household and the entire Gentile mission. See, I don't think conversion is a one-off thing. I don't think we're just called and we're invited, hey, become a Christian, become a follower of Jesus, at whatever age that happens in our lives. I think it has to be constant and ongoing. I think we have to be constantly talking to God about how we're moving towards being like Jesus. And we're moving this way, and then he says, oh, now that you're a bit closer, you got to adjust a little bit more this way. And so there's another conversion. And I don't know what it is in your lives or in your hearts that needs to be converted. We don't become a Christian and then it's just all good from then on in. We're constantly a work in progress. And I think the biggest damage that's ever done in our world by Christians is done when we think, well, I became a Christian, I'm safe, I'm all good, nothing more to worry about. Because it takes humility to acknowledge that we have more to learn and more to be converted. Peter was like the head apostle. He was the leader of the disciples. He's the one who on Pentecost had gone out and preached this sermon that like converted 3,000 people to become followers of Jesus. How extraordinary is that? And now he's the one who's told, go to the Romans' house. The Apostle Paul knew that he was right. He was a faithful Jewish man. He was a Pharisee. He knew the law inside and out. He did everything in his life. Everything was motivated by wanting to honor God by the way that he lived his life until he was knocked over by that blinding light. And everything changed and continued to change as he grew more and more and more into Jesus' likeness. What do we need to be converted from today? Or what do we need to be converted to? In the words from last week, what do we need to be freed from? Or what do we need to be freed for? We started a newish song last week called No Longer Slaves, and we're going to be singing that in just a short time. And the reason I chose that we would end with that, even though we weren't specifically talking about slavery, is because I'm convinced that everything in our lives that doesn't look like Jesus is holding us back from freedom. Because I think Jesus is all about freedom. And it feels weird because we think, oh, I have freedom to do this or I have freedom to do that. I can say no if I want and I can do whatever I want with my time. And that might sound like freedom, but Jesus offers something different. Jesus says, if you follow my ways, if you obey my commandments, then you'll be truly free. It's like children. If children don't have boundaries in their lives, then they get into all sorts of trouble, and they also never, ever feel safe. And as soon as you set up boundaries for children, they can run around and do what they like inside those boundaries and feel safe and actually feel free. Dogs are the same. If dogs don't have rules, if dogs don't have boundaries around them, if dogs don't know that you're in charge, then they develop this kind of anxiety because they're always having to keep an eye out and they're having to look and they have to be cautious and protect you and protect them and protect anybody else and fight people. And if they have boundaries, I have a friend who does dog training and if you have this dog who knows that you're in charge as the owner, who knows that you've got their back, then they can go along on a walk happy as can be, even if they're on a short leash or anything like that, because they're free from the fears and the anxieties. I think the big thing that Jesus wants to free us from is this age-old belief that if we're in control, we are the most free. And Jesus says, let me be in control, and then you will know true freedom. Then you will know true life. And in all these people, in Paul, in Peter, in Cornelius, in the Ethiopian eunuch, even in Philip, I think by turning their life over to Jesus, by surrendering it all, they, for the first time perhaps, knew what it was to be truly free. And so I ask you again, and I invite you to think about this. What do you need to be converted from? What might be God inviting you to that requires a shift in the way that you think, or a shift in your attitude towards the world, or a change in heart, maybe even toward yourself? And I invite you to think about that as we spend some time in prayer before moving into this declarative song that we are no longer slaves.